It's Monday, February 21, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The news broke on Friday as the Obama administration reversed a Bush-era regulation known as a conscience clause. The Bush administration had put it into place through the Department of Health and Human Services by presidential directive. As President Bush put the policy into effect, those who are medical personnel could not be forced to act against conscience. Now, the law had already been in effect as a standing regulation when it comes to abortion. But now the Bush administration law that expanded that, given new medical technologies, to include medical treatments such as emergency contraceptives and medical treatments that might be demanded in order to facilitate homosexual sex, well, those regulations are now withdrawn. As was reported by the national media, the Bush regulation had been basically gutted by the Obama administration. Catherine Sebelius, the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, simply said that the Bush administration policy had been unclear and could be overbroad. Well, let's understand what's going on here. At my website at albertmoeller.com, I published an article on Friday that reminds us that what we have here is a case in which the conscience is now trampled by the regime. This kind of conscience regulation was put in place by the Bush administration so that those institutions hiring medical personnel could not require them by the fact that they are supported by taxes to violate conscience. Now, this is a large area of the law of medical practice ethics that is going to be expanding and certainly rising in terms of urgency. The reasons for this become clear. As, for instance, the normalization of homosexuality grows apace with trends in the culture, will we require that medical doctors, just as a course of the fact that they are practicing medicine, must not only treat gay patients, but facilitate gay sex and gay relationships? Do we require medical doctors to violate their conscience by prescribing and administering abortifacient drugs? If we do require such persons to act in violation of their conscience, we are basically asking doctors to act in violation of their own medical oath, which is, we're asking them to act in ways that they believe are actually injurious to the health of their patients and that violate their own conscience. Back when abortion was legalized in 1973, the inevitable collision between medical ethics and the new supposed freedom of women to have an abortion was immediate, such that there had to be some accommodation. And the conscience regulations were put into place so that no doctor, at least in terms of a tax-supported institution, could be required to perform an abortion if he believes, indeed, that it is the taking of an innocent human life. What would it say if we as a nation required doctors to perform abortions just in order to keep their jobs? As straightforward as that question now sounds, applied to other areas of very similar medical ethics, that's exactly what the Obama administration is going to do. I entitled my article, Conscience Trampled by the Regime, because this is a fundamental issue of individual liberty and conscience. It's the kind of issue that was very much on the heart and concern of those who founded this nation, who wanted to make certain that we did not trample upon individual liberty and private conscience. What the Obama administration now proposes to do is to allow the enforcement of requirements that medical personnel act in ways that violate their conscience. There's another way to look at this. Not only is it the fact that these medical professionals now will have their conscience trampled by the regime, it also points out the desperation of the regime when it comes to these policies. In other words, you're going to have to require many medical doctors to perform these acts, otherwise they would not be done. In other words, a significant number of medical professionals consider abortifacient drugs and other medical treatments to be immoral, unethical, and unhealthy. Now, regardless of their personal concerns, there will be no protection for these individuals in terms of a government policy that relates to tax-supported institutions. I find it hard to believe that Americans who would understand this reality will stand by and idly observe the consciences of their neighbors and their own physicians compromised and indeed trampled upon. But we'll see. This is the kind of thing that happens in a bureaucratic culture that often goes rather sight unseen. That's the reason I wrote my article. I'm greatly troubled, I will admit, by the fact that this issue is not getting greater attention, and I can only hope that a significant number of Americans are awakened not only to the threat to the consciences of these medical professionals, but to all of us by extension, because the revoking of this particular policy lays bare the desperation of the regime that will not end with the violation of the consciences of only medical professionals. Another story over the weekend has to do with conscience, and it has deservedly received a good deal of attention. Joel Northup, a homeschooled sophomore in Iowa who was 35-4, that is, he had 35 wins and only 4 losses wrestling for the Linmar High School, gave up a chance at a particular win by forfeiting a match because he would not wrestle against a female wrestler. In a statement that he released, Joel Northup said that his own Christian convictions would not allow him to wrestle with a girl. He spoke very candidly about the fact that the intimate physical contact that would be involved was, in his view, inappropriate. Also, by extension, in the view of his parents. Now, in this case, what we have is something that is not isolated to Iowa. This is the kind of story that is going to be showing up time and time again. I wrote about this a couple of years ago when a similar case emerged in California. The reality is that, for fairly predictable reasons, there is a very small number of female high school wrestlers. There are not enough for girls to have their own wrestling tournaments in most states. So, in Iowa, boys are now required to wrestle with girls. Well, without going into physical detail, wrestling is indeed one of the most intensely of all physical sports. It is not the kind of thing that boys are accustomed to competing with in terms of their opponents being girls. In this case, Joel Northup is actually doing what most of us would recognize to be the right thing. What we have here is not just a situation that is related to developments from Title IX and other federal policies. What we have here is a worldview clash. In this case, this girl, her school, and her parents are demanding that she have the right to wrestle against boys in order that she can fulfill her own ambitions as a wrestler. But that means that the consciences of the boys against whom she would compete simply have to give way, or the boys have to forfeit the match. There's something deeply wrong here. There's something upside down in a society that suggests that individual liberty in this case means that a girl can actually demand to compete in wrestling, of all things, with high school boys. This is only a small picture of what's going on in America, but it's the kind of collision, morally and in terms of worldview, that is going to expand issue by issue, perhaps even sport by sport and school by school, as this kind of nonsense proliferates. One of the big stories in terms of media developments over the past couple of years has been the demise, or at least the displacement, of the 3 big news weeklies. U.S. News and World Report is now no longer even available in print form. Newsweek is going through a transformation under new ownership with a radical reinvention planned. And alone among the big 3, Time Magazine continues pretty much in the same form as in the past, but with a much smaller readership. Time Magazine continues to be important, especially when it comes to international news and the reporting that is available through the depth of those that it has listed on its masthead. One of the most important names when it comes to international reporting with Time Magazine is Fareed Zakaria. And in the current cover story having to do with unrest in the Middle East, the cover, by the way, reads, "The Generation Changing the World," Mr. Zakaria brings a very keen point to our discussion about what's going on not only in Tunisia and Egypt, Bahrain and Yemen, but throughout the Arab world. It's a generational transformation. For instance, as Mr. Zakaria writes, "The central underlying feature of the Middle East crisis is a massive youth bulge. About 60% of the region's population is under 30. These millions of young people have aspirations that need to be fulfilled, and the regimes in place right now show little ability to do so." End quote. Let's think about this in terms of the collision of 2 very interesting forces, both of them generational. As Mr. Zakaria points out, 6 out of 10 of the residents of these Arab nations are under age 30. So you have a youth wave that's significant in and of itself. But these young people are not merely young and filled with aspirations, they are also digital. And so they have means at their disposal in terms of communication and social media that were available to no previous generation. Tyrants are now trembling at the force of Twitter and Facebook and other forms of social media. And as Mr. Zakaria makes clear in this cover story, the fact that this generation is now so ambitious in terms of change is going to lead to inevitable transformations throughout the Middle East. There's another very interesting point to be made here. Christians need to keep in mind that our embeddedness in time and in place is important to our personal identity. We also need to remember that in the unfolding of history, demographics often very clearly do matter. Back in the 1960s, the United States was in a position that is somewhat akin to where much of the Arab world is right now. After Americans ended World War II and the soldiers and sailors came home, they began what became known as the baby boom. It was no coincidence that in the United States, it was in the 1960s into the 1970s that this nation faced some of its most crucial social and moral foment. By no accident, it was the baby boomers come of age as teenagers and young adults. They went into the streets as hippies and flower children and war protesters. It's pretty much analogous to what's going on throughout much of the Arab world. Where you have a concentration of the very young, the issues get framed in ways that are driven by their youthful aspirations, their protest against a lack of power, and the interest they bring with connectivity, time, and the ability to relate that can often work around the stolid but rather forceful institutional power of their parents. What we're seeing in the Middle East is the unfolding of a story that is now beginning but is not about to end. As we experienced in watching the news over the weekend, the crackdowns in Bahrain and, for instance, in Libya are an example of the fact that many of these regimes do not intend to go the way of Tunisia and Egypt. There is a good deal of concern about this royal house, for instance, of Saudi Arabia, the House of Saud, which has to be watching these developments with a very wary eye. As many observers have pointed out, there are basically two ways that these Arab regimes have kept down the aspirations of young people. The first is by force, and the second is by buying them off. That's basically done in so many of the oil-rich countries by taking the oil money and giving it to the population in order that material goods might make them forget the fact that they are robbed of the liberties they so desire. It looks like both of these strategies are running thin in the Middle East, and as these generational demographics point out, it's a lasting trend that isn't going to go away anytime soon. There's a good deal to watch as we go into this week, and I'll be back tomorrow with the briefing. Thanks for listening. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information about Southern Seminary, go to sbts.edu. And for information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. Again, let me remind you that Mary and I are going to be taking a cruise to Alaska this summer. It'll be a time of fellowship and intensive Bible study. We hope you'll want to go with us. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com and click on the icon. We'll look forward to seeing you there. And I'll meet you again tomorrow for the briefing.